Like every other state in the country, Indiana has been reforming its elementary and secondary schools pretty much nonstop for at least 35 years, ever since Ronald Reagan's National Commission on Excellence in Education issued the landmark report, A Nation at Risk. Now, that report famously concluded that our schools were being, quote, eroded by a rising tide of mediocrity that threatens our very future as a nation. Then Governor Robert Orr responded by pushing through his so-called A-plus reform package, which, among other things, established mandatory testing and remediation, a school accreditation system, and incentive pay for teachers. Now, A-plus, that's about as good as it gets, right? Well, maybe not. Eager to secure the moniker Education Governor, each of Bob Orr's successors, Bayh, O'Bannon, Kernan, Daniels, Pence, and now Holcomb, has sought at least some additional reforms, often triggering political brawls fierce enough to cow the toughest schoolyard bully. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll take advantage of the relative calm of this year's legislative session to assess the impact, positive and negative, of continual education reform. Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
Purdue Startup Speak Modalities, helping children and families coping with nonverbal autism to develop communication skills, helping people, changing lives. Purdue Research Foundation. Contact innovation at prf.org.
So let's talk about education reform. Here in Indiana, we've pursued any number of buzzworthy and yet on occasion seemingly divergent objectives. We've labeled education our number one priority, yet curbed the long-term authority of the state's top education official. We've demanded rigorous uniform standards, yet bemoaned teaching to the test. We've celebrated local decision-making, yet threatened underperforming districts with state oversight. We've called for accountability and transparency, and yet allowed charter schools to operate largely in the shadows. And we've championed computer science as a bedrock skill, yet proposed mandatory instruction in cursive writing. Here to discuss Indiana's ongoing effort to improve K through 12 education are State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, a first-term Republican, Democratic Senator Eddie Melton of Gary, the ranking minority member of the Senate Education and Career Development Committee, and veteran educator Teresa Meredith, who's in her second term as president of the Indiana State Teachers Association. I thank you for being here. No issue, certainly, probably nearer and dearer to the hearts of Hoosiers than education.
Absolutely.
So, I'd probably be remiss if in a discussion of education I didn't acknowledge the tragic shooting this week in Parkland, Florida. Death toll now stands, as we tape this, at 17. Is there any takeaway for Hoosiers?
You know, we have this conversation, unfortunately, too often. So these horrific events seem to keep popping up more than anybody wants to see them happening. So our Indiana schools are working hard at preventative and responsiveness. We have a lot of training going on. We're working closely with our law enforcement. But the bottom line is, you know, we can train and we can hold our breath, but we need help from Congress. So it's just happening too frequently, and we need assistance, and it's time. It's overdue.
And when you talk about help from Congress, I presume you're talking about
Lot of different levels, with gun control and with mental health issues. I mean, we're going to have yes. help.
Senator Melton, what can we do?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with the superintendent. And, of course, my thoughts and prayers go out to the families of those that are experiencing this this tragic loss of so many students, just with the entire community. But she's absolutely correct. This is going to take an act of Congress. We're going to have to look at policy and figure out how do we best address the gun laws in this nation.
And let's go to the person who represents teachers in this state. We saw not only in this shooting, but I think I've seen we've had 18 so far mm-hmm. school shootings, mm-hmm. certainly most not nearly as with the toll this one took. But in many cases, teachers, there have been stories about the heroics of teachers who've put themselves in harm's way to shield their students.
Right.
And maybe one even lost his life perhaps in this incident.
Right.
Are teachers part of the answer to solving, I guess, you don't solve this issue to warding off these kinds of problems?
Well, I think teachers across the country are saying it's time to put feet to the prayers. It's great that people are sending thoughts and prayers, but we need action. We need some changes at the congressional level. 18 shootings since the beginning of the year and not one discussion in Congress about how to fix that, how to stop that, how to prevent it. We train teachers every year on how to train students to take cover if there's an intruder in a building. And I tell you, when you look into into the eyes of a five-year-old and have to explain why you're doing this, it's gut-wrenching. It is gut-wrenching. I spoke with some college students last night who are studying to be teachers, and to have that conversation with them was quite emotional last night.
And I think it sounds as if the push for it, we've talked about reform, but that will be the topic of today's show, but I guess this is a reform, while not on anybody's agenda necessarily formally in the session, the notion of lobbying Congress, appealing to federal officials to take steps that might help remedy these situations. Is that high on your list,
Superintendent? Absolutely. And I will tell you, Indiana schools, every day, that's our priority, to keep children safe and to keep educators safe and keep community safe. And so that's our priority. But again, we can't do it alone. We have to have some assistance.
All right. Well, other types of reform,
yes.
Maybe a little less serious. Although, based on the animosity they've created, maybe not a lot less serious over the past 30, 35 years, we've seen this virtually every session has been marked by some sort of very big disagreement, pitch battle, if you will, on education reform. This session seems to be not so much. Now, certainly you all have agendas that you brought to the table, but we haven't seen as much of the fighting over, say, accountability or vouchers, you know, the school choice, those types of things. To what can we attribute this relative calm, do you think?
I think we're preparing for next session. So I think it's not a budget year, and that plays into it. But we have a lot of things that are pressing right now as far as the Indiana diploma issue, as far as, you know, watching that graduation rate, and accountability is going through rulemaking right now with the State Board of Education. So a lot of things happening, but I think we're getting ready for next year to see what happens with many of those things that you mentioned.
And if there aren't some changes in the graduation requirements and we don't comply with the new federal guidelines, our graduation rates could seemingly plummet.
Correct. And we were looking for some help from the U.S. Ed. And so we were hoping, we put in our ESSA plan, we put in a waiver. We're not holding our breath on that waiver, so we're going to have some legislative help from our General Assembly. And we've had some great conversations from the House and the Senate, and we feel like we can get that done. But that is one of our top priorities this year.
And one of the things I do want to talk about is this notion of how many diplomas.
Right.
What's the right number? You know, I know you've been an advocate of having one instead of, what, four, which
right.
the State Board of Education is gearing toward. But we'll get to that. What do you credit with this calm? Is it the suggestion that everybody's just taking a collective deep breath, maybe, you know, carbo loading before next year's session? Or is it maybe some sort of fatigue about reform? As I mentioned, it seems like every year the drumbeat has sounded. Or here's a thought. Is it different, the lineup, the personnel has maybe contributed to that?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all those that you mentioned, but I also think there's a common theme among both the Democrats and Republicans to address some key issues, one being workforce development. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of legislation that brought forth to address our workforce development needs from our early childhood education all the way to through high school. And our concern as a caucus was, how do we streamline this process and make it more efficient, where different departments are working collaboratively across the board to address this issue that our industries are telling us they need highly qualified workers to be prepared for the demand in the future.
And I remember that's an issue that goes back to even the Biden administration. I remember covering the news conference where he announced a streamlining of workforce development efforts. So I guess who says this isn't a cyclical history in which
yeah.
we live. How's the relationship that you have in terms of ISTA, and which at times has been, let's say, at odds? I mean, you were the lead plaintiff in a suit that determined the legality under Indiana's constitution of private school vouchers, and that certainly created some angst in all quarters. But am I right? It seems to be calmer this session.
Well, I think it is a budget year, so that is part of not a budget
yeah.
year, and that is why it seems to
scared these guys from
yeah, it's
there.
Not
they're
a budget
thinking,
year.
Where is that budget?
That is why there's a little bit of calm. I think there are some issues, but we are able to have some conversations and get in and at least share our teachers' perspectives, our members' perspectives. So we'll see if we can make some impact. There are a couple of things we're really watching closely that we hope to have some serious impact on, particularly around the Gary and Muncie conversation. But I think by and large, it's not a budget year. People are focused on planning for next year, and then there are just some cleanup things. I think there is some reform fatigue as well. At some point, you have to stop and let students experience, let educators experience the laws that have been put in place and be able to look at that data then and see if it's working or if it isn't. So it's been good to have a little bit of a break from.
Well, since you brought up Gary and Muncie, I guess we feel obliged to go there, since that is one that has if we haven't had outright battles, this is probably as close as any issue might come this session. Of course, we've had a mechanism for schools to take over, for the state, I should say, to take over poorly performing schools, chronically poorly performing schools. And in fact, we've seen that to move forward on several fronts after the requisite six consecutive years of failed schools. But now we have this issue where Muncie schools, based on legislation that's now pending, Ball State University might take over Muncie schools, and Gary, which is facing financial difficulties, their school board effectively would become little more than an advisory group without any clout. I should say, as we tape this, we don't exactly know what fireworks might come, and I'm suspecting there will be some in the coming hours. But what's your take on all that?
Let me first start by saying I believe that the state shouldn't be in the business of taking over schools. I think this is setting a very difficult precedent as we move forward and making it difficult for local districts to adjust to local issues and problems. For example, when we talk about Gary's fiscal concerns and issues, all of the pieces of the contributing factors are not discussed. It's always the blame upon administrators and board members, which rightfully so, there are some issues that have contributed historically there. But there are also local policies and state policies that help contribute to that. The property tax cap that was put in place around 2009 in Gary, we have a low collection rate in property taxes, low assessed value. Student population has dramatically dropped over the last 10 years because we have a proliferation of charter schools. Gary was ranked sixth in the nation with the most charters. So there's a plethora of contributing factors when we talk about what puts a district in this particular position. So we have to have that holistic conversation versus focusing on one particular area and making it punitive for the entire community, which, and I totally disagree with, you know, we live in democracy and folks elect particular individuals to represent them in a particular field, be it on a city council or on a school board. And although this body doesn't have the power to manage the district, they do have a voice to represent their constituency.
Now, you mentioned that you're not a fan of seeing the state take over schools, but in many cases, when the state has taken action with individual schools that have been underperforming, we've seen the state actually outsource the job either to another local school or a company that either for-profit or non-profit that does this. So does that matter to you, whether it's the state actually doing it or whether it's the state in name but actually in principle is a third-party contractor?
It does matter. I believe that when we look at outsourcing it, you know, from a private entity perspective, is it driven by fiscal demand or need from the agency to stay within that district? Will they give every effort to turn it around? And in my opinion, we have to really evaluate that and make sure the best intentions are for the students to be successful in the entire community to come around those particular schools. Very quickly, I'll just say this. There are schools across the state that has been taken over for the last 5 and 6 years, and they're probably still at that D or F grade level and haven't achieved the success that some of the schools may have achieved around them.
So we saw that with Arlington High School, for instance, here in Indianapolis, yes, which was still having difficulties. Superintendent, weigh in on this.
So I think there is a big difference, too, at times between the academic distress and fiscal distress. In the Gary situation, we have a little bit of both, unfortunately.
A lot of one in terms of $4 million, I guess, is the debt. Right.
So for those fiscally distressed districts, I mean, those are pretty much outliers. We have two that have been deemed that. I mean, the Muncie situation is very different, honestly, from the Gary situation, but from the department's perspective, we have been to support and to guide schools. You know, our goal too is never to take over schools, even for academic purposes. We want schools locally to be in control. Everybody has unique strengths and unique opportunities, but also there are some big struggles that are happening. So we want students to have opportunity and find success, and sometimes that does mean intervention, but I also like to see exit plans, and I like those to be clear and making sure that, you know, the goal should be improvement, get those districts out of those situations and then get them back to their local communities. And so we're still in the early phases of the fiscally distressed units as far as schools, but it's an interesting area where we're going. And I know they need assistance fiscally, but it's very expensive for the state as well. So,
Teresa Meredith, if I'm not mistaken, the legislation, this bill, which we're talking about, and some of the other state takeover bills, for lack of a better way to describe it, basically allow a lot of latitude for the removal of teachers, for cost-saving measures and so forth, allow the emergency managers. Is that the most troubling aspect of this to you, or is it? Is there something else here that we should be paying attention to?
Multifaceted. You know, initially the legislature is responsible for creating that school funding formula. So I think there needs to be a review of that again to determine what exactly needs to be done to change that formula so that we don't have more schools ending up in fiscal distress, even though they're doing well and they have a steady student population. In this particular bill itself, we're greatly concerned about disrupting the stability for students. When you look at removing teachers from classrooms well into a school year, you're talking about definitely creating an unstable environment for students who are then going to go into the spring testing mode. So it's very unfair to the students and it's unfair to those educators. There is nothing in that bill about cutting back in the administrative pool prior to making those kinds of cuts among teachers. And in the Muncie situation, the teachers were the ones who helped bring to light the financial challenges. They were also the ones to make the sacrifices of paying back money from past insurance costs. They were the ones who made the difficult recommendation of making reductions in force. And so they want to be part of the solution, and so I think they deserve to be included in the conversation, and they deserve to have a voice in whatever happens moving forward with Muncie.
And a couple of you have talked about financial difficulties, and you suggested the need to reassess the way dollars are distributed in the school funding formula. There was a miscalculation, we all know, in the current biennium. What is it, $9.3 million is the shortfall. One bill that seems to, a lot of bills didn't get hearings, but one that both the House and Senate bill that did emerge and seem in all likelihood to be graced with the governor's signature is a measure that would plug that gap and maybe add a little bit of flexibility. $25 million in reserves would be available to schools. Anything that's standing in the way of that becoming law and schools getting a little bit of a financial stopgap in the short term?
No, I don't see anything that's going to stand in the way in this particular session that's going to hinder that from happening. But I think we need to have a deeper conversation and figuring out how do we prevent this from happening in the future and adequately, like we mentioned earlier, funding schools to ensure, you know, shift in population and other contributing factors. So we really have to have a very thorough discussion on how do we ensure that every school corporation, be it rural, urban, suburban, is adequately funded.
And right now, funding tends to follow the student as opposed to be tied to performance or the outcomes. Particularly obvious when you look at charter schools and some of the virtual schools, which there were several proposals, actually Republican proposals, both from the House and Senate, that never went anywhere this session. There seemed to be concern on the part of their authors that there just was more frustration with the bills, potentially. And yet, isn't that what we're talking about here, the need for accountability and transparency, and so we know where these tax dollars are going?
Absolutely. With that shortfall, we appreciate Senator Mishler and Representative Brown's work on that. And right now, we're at 20 to 23 million is the gap, and next year we know that could be close to double. So when we're talking about those types of monies and we're talking about efficiency, we have to have quality schools. And so much of the language that we were pushing for addressed some of that, making sure there was quality, accountability, transparency, and that's going to be extremely important when everybody fighting for the limited amount of dollars that are available. We think it is extremely important that there is an eye on quality.
And why then do you think that even though the authors of bills that would have added a degree of accountability, these were not backbenchers. In one case, you had a committee chair that had put forth this legislation. Usually that's a signal that something's going to at least get out of committee. And yet, not. What's your take?
Yeah, I think it's something we still have to have conversations about. We're watching the fiscal piece of that as well. A great example of that is common school loans. What's happening to common school loans when charters come into Indiana and leave Indiana and you still have an outstanding debt in the common school loan area? So there are a lot of factors that we still need to have an eye on, make sure we hold people accountable, including those authorizers, and just have more conversations about it. So the appetite's got to be there, and we will continue to have those hard talks.
And this is a parallel, perhaps, to the question I just asked you from an ISTA's perspective. Mm-hmm. But before, I was asking about dollars and accountability. Also, teacher licensure and so forth. Mm-hmm. Some of these schools have greater latitude in terms of hiring a certain percentage of teachers who are not licensed in the traditional sense, or even if they're licensed, they have charter licenses, which arguably are easier to obtain. How big a problem is that?
Let me ask you this. Do you want to go into surgery and have 70, 80, 90% of the surgeons in that hospital well-trained and have the right credentials and the right experiences to prep them for that surgery and roll the dice and hope you get one of those? Do you really want to put someone who's not well-trained and put them in front of a classroom of students? I would say no. I would argue that no. You need someone who is well-qualified, well-trained, who understands children, who has been through the right kinds of programs to be ready to teach. Teaching is not an easy.
Why do you think we're doing? I mean, is it because we're worried about not enough students? I know in the case, for instance, of some of the STEM fields, the push is to get people at least on an interim basis while they're obtaining their credentials. Limited numbers could come in, but do you think there's something more lurking here just philosophically about?
Perhaps. I think so. I think if we were really serious about things like the teacher shortage, we would look at the minority scholarship that the legislature created for minorities to go into STEM. But it was never funded. So how do you go out and recruit folks and say, we have these scholarship monies, but yet we don't? We have the scholarship, but there's no money for it. So it's difficult to go out and do the recruitment piece and offer financial assistance if the legislature doesn't put money with the bills that they create. So that's tough.
Senator, I mean, we often hear teachers are the ones who can make or break a student's career, and yet we seem to be loosening the reins on who can become a teacher.
No.
Cause for alarm, or is that the way things should unfold?
No, absolutely. We brought this discussion up in our education committees in terms of how do we address this. I think where the balance we're trying to figure out is particular skill set, and you know, you talked about it earlier, it's computer science and other technical areas in terms of being professional licensed in those areas. So, you know, we had to figure out when we're going to move past just moving past the dialogue and figure out the policies that's going to have a direct impact and listen to educators and put that into the policies that we're mandating on them. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to come on the show to have that discussion, so I'm glad that came up.
Well, as you know, as we talk about some of the big picture issues here, but curriculum issues, it seems, if there are bills that have gotten hearings this session, they tend to do. We talked about the cursive writing, we talked about the availability of computer science education. We've talked about changing the way that sex ed is handled from an opt-out to an opt-in, where parents would have to, you know, take the onus is on them to say it's in. What do you make of all this? We want to have local control, but is this what we should be doing as a state?
Yeah, something about the flexibility we talked about with education. I mean, schools are going to have some flexibility because of the situation with the teacher supply, but we also have to have flexibility in that curriculum instruction area. You know, I support the work that we're doing in computer science, but many schools have already started that, but we need assistance, and some of that's fiscal, and so we support that. We are not supporters of the cursive writing bill. Many of our local schools are doing that, so we're like, leave that to a local decision. You know, at a time where we're getting ready for computer adaptive testing and our focus on cursive writing, it just doesn't seem to align with what's happening with the workforce needs and our academic needs. So the human sexuality bill is very problematic for our schools. Many of our most at-risk students would have to opt in, and that's very difficult.
I'm getting a sign that the school bell is about to ring for us. But last, you're going to get 5 seconds apiece. A lot of you wanted to see early intervention here on the part of children. The age mandatory requirement now, 7 years you have to be in school. It would be down to 5 under some of the ideas that you've advanced. You got 5 seconds. When are we going to finally see this, if we ever will?
Well, hopefully we'll see something next session when talking about across the entire state instead of just a few select
counties. Pilot programs.
The conversation needs to definitely continue if we are going to get serious about serving our students.
That's the conversation and getting serious, not the actual when is it going to happen prediction. But
ditto, but the good news here is that more kids are attending traditional public schools now. That's good.
All right. Obviously, so much more we could talk about, but I thank you for coming and sharing your thoughts on, again, very important issue for everyone in the state of Indiana. Again, my guests have been State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick, Democratic Senator Eddie Melton of Merrillville, or I should say Gary, he recently moved, trying to get away from the snow, and Teresa Meredith, President of the Indiana State Teachers Association. They say self-driving vehicles are the future. If so, is Indiana at the crossroads of this new technology? On the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight and its sister publication, Indiana Education Insight, both part of Hannah News Service. Ed, make sense of some of the issues we just talked about and what we didn't talk about.
Well, we hit it last week when I told you that we were going to be getting into a real controversial area with the school takeovers, and that has proven problematic, and it's going to continue to be over the next week and a half or so, and then through the end of the session. There are some real concerns about criteria that are being advanced for how we do this. You know, what is it that we say, you know, constitutes a reason for takeover of these schools? There's a bill with about 20 different things, and some of the Democrats say, hey, these aren't appropriate, these aren't enough, we need to do some more thinking. Then there are all kinds of questions about, well, how much local control is, as you heard from Senator Melton, you know, should we be giving up as part of this when some of the problems were facilitated by the state?
How about this distinction that was drawn on the part of the superintendent about the difference between chronic academic problems and financial problems? Do you see that as an area along which there's disagreement in the caucuses?
Absolutely. And the Democrats say, well, look back to when we started the charter schools, and that started the fiscal decline and the property tax caps as well. And that's one of the things that they're pointing at. There's a lot more going on in the legislature than just education this session, too, though.
Well, let's talk about it. This was an interesting week. We're past the halfway point in the short session. We had a few interesting developments on the legislative leadership front.
Big surprise, the retirement announcement by Senate President Pro Tem David Long, who's been the pro tem now for 20-some years. And we've only had two presidents of the Senate presidents pro tem since 1982. So this will be a big cultural change for the Senate when he steps down at the end of November.
What's the immediate impact, do you think, in terms of his successor, the battle for that position, if there is one?
Yeah, there will be a big shakeup. You're going to have a different direction in the Senate, and it's going to be a real challenge for whoever replaces him to be able to do the same kind of coalition building that he did in keeping disparate parts of the Senate together.
Because we've often said it's tougher to oversee a supermajority in a caucus than, in many ways, a minority.
Yeah, it's like herding cats in the Senate.
And are you going to put in an envelope who the name will be of his successor? Are you willing to do that or go out on a limb here?
I'd love to be able to name some names. I think that right now it's going to be between Senator Travis Holdman, who chairs the Committee on Tax and Fiscal Policy, the new chair of that committee,
right,
and the Majority Floor Leader, Rod Bray, from Martinsville.
All right. It'll be interesting to watch. Ed, thank you as always for your insight. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media, Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, and my colleague Ed Feigenbaum, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House coverage. Until next week, take care.
Visual Analytics Law Enforcement Toolkit, or VALET, developed at Purdue University, brings critical data and analytics to police departments instantly, so officers are a step ahead of criminal activity. To learn more, visit otc-prf.org.